So, I'm the last person of the day, so I guess I'm going to be very brief, maybe 5 minutes. Okay, all right, okay. So, okay, let me also mention something. I don't know if you've heard that people who take selfies with people they've never met before, many of them have died within 1 or 2 years, so it's very bad luck. Okay, so I'm just warning you about the selfie thing because it's very dangerous. Anyway, so before I start the lecture, connecting skin in the game, absence of skin in the game to the political system and things that are very intellectual, I'm going to tell you how I write because that's the first question people ask me. The way I write is as follows. You write something that is relevant today and can be interesting, and you make sure it would have been also relevant 20 years ago. If you do that, then it's likely to be relevant 20 years from now. So, in other words, do not work on the future, work on the past. And that, I discovered, is very effective to predict the life of a technology. If a technology is working well today, was working well 20 years ago, odds are it'll be working well 20 years from now. So that's the technique of writing based on what I call the Lindy effect. The second thing that I do is I bundled all my books in one. You try to not write pieces, body parts. And we're going to talk about complex systems today. Complex systems have one main characterization, which is what? That the ensemble is not a sum of components. You cannot separate the components. There's interactions. That's called fractal order. So you try to write every chapter, you see, should look like a book. And every book should look like a series. So I put everything in a five-volume series. Why five-volume series? Crass commercialism. Because when someone buys one, they're forced to buy the other one. Okay, nothing more interesting. You just make sure there's no overlap. So the whole thing, and then it's much easier because when people ask me, what books did you write? I say, I just wrote one. No more, just the inserto. Okay, simple. No more Cisnes Negros and all stuff like that. Okay, so now let me start with the core of the idea of skin in the game and where we're going to go with it. My national origin is this, pit trader. I was a trader in a pit. I don't know if any of you, if you guys are familiar with trading in a pit, you get germs, you get sick. The first 2 years, you get very, very sick for every single disease you contract because you got people spitting in your mouth when you're shouting, right? So I was a pit trader, and this is where I learned about risk and probability. Then I retired from trading, and I discovered very sorely that I was incapable at anything not related to probability. Like, you can't play tennis. I lose concentration in the middle of the game. So I can't play chess. People, want to kill me because I fall asleep or something. So I was forced to start to do math. So follow the sequence of pit trader. Then I wrote books that became popular. Okay, usually it's the reverse. And then the third one is start doing mathematics. So now for 10 years, professionally, that's what I do. Mathematics of risk and statistics. So it's backwards. So why am I saying this? I'm saying this because I've noticed one central point, a central thing, is that when you go from this to that, you think differently, very differently, versus if you went from this to that, which is traditional route. You teach someone statistics, probability, whatever it is, the kind of bullshit they teach you in business school, then send them to real life. Guess what? They're not going to have a clue. If you do things in reverse, it's much more interesting, and nobody is going to ever be able to bullshit you. That's the whole idea. Sorry for using a Latin word in the middle of a sentence. Okay? So this is the idea of the main idea that I've been proposing, okay? That when you go from one to the other. Incidentally, an interesting anecdote is that I wrote in my book something about the Ludic fallacy, which is that the real world does not resemble games. And I hate modern art, and someone sent me this. There is an exhibit on this idea of the ludic fallacy at Saatchi in London, and I looked at it, I couldn't connect this art to the idea of the ludic fallacy. The ludic fallacy meaning that the real world does not resemble the world of textbooks and games. So I still don't understand that. So if someone understands it, please, you know, let me know, because I have no idea, okay? Okay, so let me start with something, it's very, very contemporary topic, but the very old one, the expert problem. The problem of experts that we think are experts but are not experts, or people we don't think are experts effectively are experts. Who is the expert? Where are the experts? So, let's talk about the restaurant business. So, when I stopped trading, I retired from trading. You know, I went, as I said, into non-tennis, non-whatever, non-chess, because I was incapable. A friend of mine, and then went into academia, and now sort of back to trading, by the way, but don't tell anyone. So, a friend of mine decided to go into the restaurant business, where he, for the last 15 years, have been losing his money extremely steadily, all right, this restaurant business, in New York City. And he made the following discovery, that restaurants have, there's a whole ecology of people who talk about restaurants. The two kind of people, the people like you who have a credit card. Now you have a credit card, you go to the restaurant and use your credit card. And then there are a collection of people who talk about restaurants, food critics, people like that. So there are awards in the restaurant business, and like the best sushi with soft music in New York City, all right? And or the best mixture Portuguese, Chinese, and Lower Manhattan. These kind of categories, all right? And then each one of them wins, you know, the best award. And there is a gala in December. Guess what? More than half the restaurants who win awards are not there to receive them. They're bankrupt. Now, what does it tell you? There's a very, very important rule we can make from this. And it's as follows. If you are judged by your peers, or are you judged by plastic? Plastic being a credit card. You know that thing you put, you know, in a machine? Okay. Who's judging you? That restaurant award thing, in that restaurant award, people are being judged by food critics and other restaurateurs. So any business in which you are judged by peers, as we're going to talk a lot about bureaucrats. Once I start with bureaucrats, I can't stop. Bureaucrats are judged by bureaucrats, all right? Not by reality. Bus drivers are judged by reality, okay? If they're bad, they have an accident, they fall off a cliff. So yeah, there are two categories of people. Those who are judged by their peers, like academia, guess what? That business rots. It starts being initially very good. Then you give it 10, 15, 20, 30 years, it rots to the core. Okay? So, the expert problem is as follows. This is a very famous cartoon that I think doubled my blood pressure the minute I saw it. Okay? I went into a state of rage in a New Yorker, where it says, you know, there have been some criticism of so-called experts in the United States, and and this cartoon is about people saying, oh, yeah, no, of course, you guys are rioting against the experts, what they call populist movement, and look, you know, the pilot, we're going to replace him. That's not true. That is pure intellectual sophistry, and let me explain to you why. The pilot is an expert, because where are the pilots who are not experts? They are at the bottom, a few French people at the bottom of the Atlantic, the Pacific Atlantic, you know, the Rio-Paris thing, a lot at the bottom of the Black Sea, some at the bottom near Malaysia, some near the North Pole, so they are dead. Bad pilots are dead, okay? Where are bad bureaucrats. They're still there. Okay. But it's very easy to judge an expert if the field has expertise, and that's what I call skin in the game. The plumber, if the plumber is not an expert, how long will it take you to figure it out? 16 seconds? Okay. So the plumber, now how do the plumber make money? At year end, they go and there's a committee of other plumbers, and then there is a senior plumber who signs off on your bonus declared by other plumbers? No. Your credit card. And basically, they're going to overcharge you. So you may complain about your plumber, okay, too nasty, too rude, too this, too this. You may complain about the expertise. Maybe there's a variation in expertise between plumbers. But I don't think anyone here will say that the field of plumbing is a field full of pseudo-experts. You agree? No, but how about economists? How about psychologists? How about all these soft fields? Okay, this is the mind of an economist on a good day, all right? I mean, a clear day, they have a lot of clarity on mind. This is how they think. Why? As we're going to see, if you're judged by reality, you have to have to be effective, you have to be have a clear mind, you have to know what you're doing. All right. If you're judged by others, what are you going to do? Do complicated stuff. Because you're not judged by reality, the impression of others. You're going to fool others by doing something very, very complicated. So you read papers in economics, they're very, very complicated. But then, you know, so you spend 6 weeks reading the paper, really, 32-page paper, very complicated. And at the end, you realize there's nothing. Right? It's all BS, but complicated. So this is what they do. And bureaucrats like to complicate things, we're going to see, to keep their own edge going. So this is the discussion that's taking place today. It has much less to do with geography, whether England or UK is part of Europe or not part of Europe, or history, Roman Empire, and has a lot more to do with the fact that when you put 200,000 empty suits in Brussels, you may get some people to complain about it. Right? Europe does not equal Brussels bureaucrats, because bureaucrats are really pseudo-experts. And if you see the effectiveness of what happened in Brussels, it's the standard case of metastatic bureaucracy. And have you heard of metastatic diseases? You know, where you have a cell that multiplies, malignancies multiply very quickly, and then they kill the host. In this case, they multiply at the expense. So, for example, I don't know, they cannot guard the borders. Why would you want to have a central authority to do things that cannot be done by locals, okay? They cannot guard the borders. They used to use Gaddafi, you know, to guard the border of Europe with the flow of migrants, and now they killed him, all right? So now they lost control of the borders. But on the other hand, they have rules that if you have a farm and you have a tractor on a farm and the tractor has a windshield, you must have a windshield wiper. And if you have a windshield wiper, the speed of windshield wiper should be no less than 27 rounds per minute, but no more than 40. That's what they spend time regulating, all right? That's what you end up doing with bureaucrats. That's the case of four experts. And they judge one another. They're judged by one another. So this is pretty much what's going on with Brexit. And you notice one thing about these bureaucrats. They're boring. I mean, you can see them. You can see them, you know, like, I'm short-sighted, but, you know, I sometimes need glasses to drive, but I don't need glasses to see a bureaucrat. I can spot one, you know, very easily from not far away. So let me summarize. There's a class of people, I call them intellectual yet idiots. Because for a specific reason, okay, is that if there's no check on the part of reality, you will never be able to figure out if they know what they know. There's another principle I wrote in Skin in the Game, and I've written earlier about it earlier in the inserto, is that it is much easier to macro bullshit than micro bullshit. Sorry for the Latin in it, but that was, you know, the text, okay? Much easier to macro BS than micro BS. Because if you're doing micro BS, if you're a weather forecaster, guess what? We're going to know if you're full of baloney or not within a week, okay? But if you're predicting climate ideas and you give us all these fancy equations, nobody will ever know if you're not, you know, just like making up things. And effectively, they are making up things. So there is that principle that things only work under evolutionary pressure. We agree? That's Darwin. So the strange thing about all these academics is that they support the idea of Darwinian evolution. They support the idea, while at the same time, they don't want it to apply to them. You see, they want to top down, and they're against teaching intelligent design, but they think they can design things from the top, into, you know, in an intelligent way. So that's the idea that I try to put in Skin in the Game. For some weird reason, I developed, while writing Skin in the Game, that's a parenthesis, an obsession with elephants. And I liked elephants for one particular reason. And the main reason is that in elephants, they don't take crap, they don't give crap. You see? They don't mess with you, but don't mess with them. That's the idea. And they have a thick skin. And we're going to go to stage two, the second point about Skin in the Game, and try to apply to the notion of symmetry and how you transfer risk from people, from some entity to another entity, or from people to other people. Let's remember one thing about pilots. Pilot crashes a plane, they die. Why is it that we don't have, I mean, in the United States we have about between 20, used to be 36,000, between 20 and 36,000 people die every year, you know, from preventable car accidents. It's high. Why isn't it much higher? Okay. Think about it. All you need is some nut to drive on a highway in the United States, or particularly in Germany, Autobahn, backwards, and you can kill in no time 30 people. Why it doesn't happen that often, or it doesn't happen? Why? Because of symmetry. Because the driver is in a car. So the bad drivers have died. So the system, if there is symmetry, if every bad driver is forced to be in a car that he or she are bad driving, or are driving badly with bad driving, then it would clean up the system from dangerous people that are dangerous for the system. Okay, so this is the idea of symmetry. Now, symmetry started with human civilization. It ceased to exist recently, 20 years ago, and definitely under Obama, it was lifted, okay? But exists, so 3,755 years ago, for those who could read, very few, or those who usually have people read for him, in Babylon stood this, and that's Hammurabi's law, code. And one of the things it says is that if you build a house and the house collapses and kills the owner, the architect shall be put to death. Now, it's not like they didn't like architects in Babylon. They did beautiful structures. The point is that you cannot create risk in a system and walk away from it. You create risk, you got to eat it. Like, you got to be in that car you're driving. If you're creating risk, you die with it, okay? Oh, so that was a good system to eliminate bad architects. And it's not just a disincentive, it's a filtering. So, and of course it has other laws that if you kill a slave, of the, you know, if the house collapses, kills a slave, I think the architect got to give you two slaves, or something like that. They're like weird rules. Now, civilization started with that. Symmetry. Eye for eye was an extension of that. Eye for eye, you know, the biblical eye for eye. So, now let's see how the symmetry started disappearing in America in a financial system, okay? This is what's known as the Bob Rubin trade. Robert Rubin was a chairperson of Goldman Sachs, went to work for the government, came back, and was a vice chairperson or chairman of Citibank, okay? Now, the trade is as follows. You make money every year. Bob Rubin got, for the 11 years he spent at Citibank, something like $120 million in compensation, okay? Nice money, you can buy, think of the vacation you can have for $120 million. You can nice car, nice condo, stuff like that, okay? So think about it. Now, and then Citibank was making a little bit of money, taking risk and hiding risks. And then Citibank, you know, was insolvent. The taxpayer had to stop up the entity. Robert Rubin, they went basically to zero. Look how much money they lost. You make. And Robert Rubin said it was a black swan. After an author that I heard is very stubborn, that's what he, you know, but has an important book. That's what he said, literally, all right? And the stubborn part was not there, but whatever. So that's what I call the Bob Rubin trade, is the architects knows more than anyone, more than the regulator, more than anyone, where he hid the risks. Because you cut them in a corner and they don't show, okay? So nobody could catch that, but the architect knows that you cannot move from Babylon, okay, pack and leave and move to Nineveh, starts a new life there, okay, because you're going to be followed now with all these people from Babylon, okay, making you accountable for risks you created. You cannot walk away from the risks you created. That's the principle of skin in the game. Your neck is on the line for everything you created. You cannot have profits and transfer your risk to other. Now, who are paying for Robert Rubin? Bus drivers? I think there are characters in my book that recur, Spanish grammar specialists, okay? Ski instructors, plumbers, all these people with their taxes are backing up Robert Rubin, okay? Now, this transfer of risk was rare. Remember, in the past, bankruptcy was something that was often dealt with in criminal law. It was not commercial law, okay? So if you cause bankruptcy, they will follow you personally. You're not shielded. So people are gaming the system, okay, of limited liability by walking away from these things, okay? Creating risks and let the taxpayer back it up. So that's a transfer of risk. But this, in fact, goes deeper. So there is a symmetry. Remember the elephant? You know, we have had rules. The main one, the most known one, is the golden rule. The golden rule is thou shall not, you shall not. Okay, you should treat others the way you want them to deal with you. Except that a good libertarian would cringe at that rule. Why? I like squid ink pasta. I can force you to eat squid ink pasta. You see, it should be, the silver rule is vastly more effective, and it says, do not do to others what you don't want them to do to you. That's a law of symmetry, okay? And practically every legal and religious system has been built on that symmetry. Okay, you don't, you know, you treat others as if they were yourselves, but in a certain way, okay? So the silver rule, it's a negative golden rule. Don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. Whereas the golden rule is more intrusive. Do to others what you want them to do to you, all right? So it makes you intrusive, okay, in their lives. No. The silver rule is vastly more potent. Anyway, so we've had a bunch of rules, and historically, they've been really applied to anything. You know, you got to eat your own cooking, okay? There's a fancy story in Greek mythology about Mercury, you know, and how to deal in the transactions. Mercury one day was walking, and some fishermen had, they got a bunch of turtles. And they said, well, come, you know, help yourself with the turtles. They didn't like to eat them. Mercury forced the fishermen to eat the turtles that they wanted him to eat. Okay? That's the notion of symmetry. If you look historically, most of the Talmudic law is also based on the symmetry in transaction. True, you have to pursue your own interest, but there are rules you can never violate. So a lot of it is based on that symmetry. But now let's continue with that symmetry. Let's go beyond that symmetry. There effectively, symmetry means you don't give risk, you don't take risk, you see? In other words, you don't transfer your risk to others, okay? But there's something even higher, is that in society, we always value those who took more risks than others. It's the exact opposite of a bureaucrat, okay? Those who bore the scars of the risk that they took. The highest, practically almost every society, except the Indian one, and I'm not that sure, okay, it could be a different interpretation, puts the warrior at the top. You want to be a count? You have to be a warrior. It doesn't come from other things. A lot of people suspect the French Revolution started when they started having what they call noblesse de robe. Noblesse de robe is people who reached the level, who became noblemen without being in war, just from desk jobs. So, I don't know if you're aware that two-thirds of Roman emperors died of violent death. And the remaining one-third, we're not sure, because, you know, when you die in your bed, can be helped by, you know, some poisoned feijoada or something, you know, or someone put some. So at least two-thirds of Roman emperors died, and some of them really, two of them died on fighting the Persians. So this is why I tweeted back, you know, Donald Trump watch out the Persians, because two Roman emperors went to fight them and died there. Okay, Roman emperors. Okay, so the rank in society was based on risk taking, and even during the Falkland Wars. Or the British aristocracy forced one of the sons of Queen Elizabeth to take more risk, because that's the only justification they got. You're only of higher rank than others because you've taken more risk. So that's the idea. So not only, you know, you're not transferring risk, you've got to bear the risk. So this is the pact you have between a peasants, serfs and the counts and dukes and the princes, is that the princes are there to defend them. So you guys do the work, I take the risk. And a lot of people see it as what we call like a peacock tail. In other words, I'm displaying my risk taking as a badge of superiority. And it worked that way. It worked that way for a long time. Even in the United States, George Bush, the father, he was in battle, and he was prisoner of war. When you think of Hannibal, he was first in battle, Hannibal. Napoleon, same thing. He was in the front. Julius Caesar, first in battle. And that was a rule. You had to be more exposed than others. You cannot hide from the battles. And so I thought about it and even found a theological dimension to it. That we're impressed by that person, no? We'd be much less impressed if it were if someone told you it's a Photoshop thing, no? Because that person really took risk for that. So this explains, in my opinion, the Trinity. That the Christian church kept insisting, I'm Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Lebanese, but the Christian church kept insisting, okay, that the Christ was Son of God but not God. Why? skin in the game. A God cannot have skin in the game, cannot suffer. A God, it would be like a video game, someone walking on this. The person is going to, but for someone to really actually suffer, it is skin in the game. So I spent some time thinking about it, and I realized that effectively all of Christian theology, particularly the Orthodox theology, they were adamant. There's no divinity to the Christ. There's a Trinity to solve the problem. Because he suffered. He took risks. So effectively, the two most influential humans or persons or whatever, however you want to define persons, because, in history were two people who died for their ideas. One of them is a talkative Athenian, who wouldn't stop talking, and the other is Christ. So realize that risk-taking is effectively something that we still value, and people like to show their scars. So I discovered one thing, and I was writing Skin in the Game during the elections, and I was at a gym where I was watching the debate. It was before the primaries, the Republican primary, where Donald Trump was running against others. And I saw this image, and something weird, I noticed something weird about the picture. The New York Times had been dumping on Donald Trump, saying, this fellow lost $1 billion. In my opinion, they got him elected. There's something real about losing $1 billion of your own money. So they say, oh, look how incompetent he is. Look at this idiot. He lost $1 billion. It makes him real because look at the other people. They don't look real. They look like phantoms. Okay? You're only real when you take risk. You have skin in the game. So that's the idea of skin in the game. And now let's discuss virtue. A lot of people don't realize that virtue is what we call cheap signaling, Like, hey, let's save the planet, so let's have your children join an NGO, and let's do this. And something that infuriates me is when I enter a hotel, I have these people telling me, let's save the planet. But in fact, you're saving your own wallet. I mean, it's not, I want to save the planet, okay? But don't use the planet as an excuse. You have all these people, this is called virtuous empty. There is no cheap virtue. It doesn't come for free. The only virtue you cannot fake is risk-taking. Risk-taking for, and that's the highest virtue. So when people ask me, what should I be doing with my life? What should I do in the future? I tell people, when they're 18, 19, 20, work on starting a business. Take risk for others. Don't join an NGO. Don't get on a salary and then claim, oh, we're saving the planet. No, take risk for others because we need risk takers who start companies. And hopefully will graduate to one day losing $1 billion. I have an article in the New York Times saying how stupid they are. Okay, you want to get there. So start a business. Your obligation is to take risks, all right? The entrepreneurs, and this society doesn't value entrepreneurs. We are the new knights. I mean, the entrepreneurs are the new knights. The new people who take risk for others, because when you think about it, New York, today is Friday, okay? You got a paycheck. Think of the people getting the paycheck. And those who gave them the paycheck, 1 in 100 will be rich, and the others will be starving, because you need 99 entrepreneurs to fail for one of them to succeed. So we should value the entrepreneur like a knight, as someone central in risk-taking. That's the second point about skin in the game. Symmetry, but then even better than symmetry, take more risk for others. So I've discovered one thing in my own public activities is I consider anything I say publicly that doesn't entail risk-taking on my part as verbiage. You have to have risks, take risks. Of course, outside mathematics and stuff like that. Okay, let me continue now. And also, you know, they have a rule. Last night at dinner, people were asking me, what do you think of the euro, this, this. You should only talk about things if you take risks in them. If you want me to talk about Brexit, I must be long or short the British pound. Why? If I'm wrong, I pay the price. You see? It should not be, it should be a filtering mechanism. If you don't have a position, you don't talk about it. Now, let's go beyond an epistemology, why you can only understand the world via that class of risk-taking or doing things. In my book, there is a story about a trader who wrote a book called How I Lost $1 Million. That was a long time ago. $1 Million was still $1 Million, all right? So that was pre-Obama, pre-bailout. It was still a lot of money, okay? So he lost $1 million trading something called green lumber, a commodity. He knew everything about green lumber. He had read every book. He knew everything about the satellites showing where lumber was, the weather pattern, the economics of it. He knew everything, everything. He had read every book, reads every magazine, has Excel spreadsheets, all kind of stuff. He lost $1 million steadily trading green lumber. He was in the same pit, not same direct same pit where I was, but in a pit in the same exchange, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And there was a trader called Joey something, okay? And that fellow was kept making money in trading many things, including green lumber. And one day, that fellow who lost $1 million discovered that Joey did not know that lumber, green lumber, was, he thought it was freshly cut lumber. He thought it was lumber that they painted green, okay? So, now let's go to the bottom of things. If you're a bureaucrat, you judge others on how much they know about weather patterns and whatever it is, okay? In the real world, you care about P&L, okay? It's very complex. Something Hayek was first, I think last, of the economists to really understand, is that there's embedded knowledge in this thing. It's not that this guy Joey, actually his name I think is Joey Siegel, all right? It's not that Joey Siegel didn't know anything about green lumber. He knew tons of things, but it's not the things that you would think you need to know from the outside when you're a bureaucrat, okay? When you're an academic, you approach the world as this is what I need to know. No, hell no, that's not. What he knew from the inside was something completely different that you probably cannot formalize. So that is the knowledge you only acquire via techne, not episteme, by doing things. Of course, a combination of theory helps. And that is the central knowledge that cannot, that's a Hayekian argument, okay? Cannot be transmitted from central planner to bureaucrat. Cannot. But I have a little twist to that story with the following heuristic. Let's say you have to go to a hospital in New York, because you know the dynamics in New York, you know how they are. You go to a hospital, you need to have brain surgery because there's a specific brain surgery, very dangerous, but if succeeds, it improves your sense of humor, okay? So you do that brain surgery, and you're gonna be able to crack jokes like nobody can, all right? Okay, so you have to do that surgery, and it's mandatory because everybody tells you you're boring, so you have to do it. So you show up at the hospital, and you have two brain surgeons. The first one looks like the idea of Hollywood would have of a brain surgeon, you know? Silver-rimmed glasses, gray hair, very extremely fluid demeanor, well-spoken, and on a wall you see effectively Ivy League degrees when you enter the office of the doctor. And you spend a conversation, really charming doctor, speaks very well, perfect. And then they tell you, but there's another doctor of the same rank that you have to consider, and you see that other doctor, thick fingers, he looks like a butcher, okay? He talks like someone from Brooklyn and doesn't have diplomas, means he's embarrassed with his diplomas, with his background, doesn't have great. Which doctor do you think you should pick? Okay, the first one? No. Because think about it, they're the same rank. If the fellow who looks like this guy managed to become a top brain surgeon in spite of every single possible prejudice you can have against him, all right? It means that he's got to be much, much better than the other guy, okay? And this is when you have contact with reality, real skills appear. Now think about it in law, for example. This is common. To work for the government, all the lawyers come from Ivy League schools, all the lawyers. The top 20, if you're not, no government jobs. Now go look at real lawyers in law firms, and they tell you, they come, the schools you didn't know existed, all right? The ones who are the rainmakers, the top lawyers. So really, this is contact with reality versus perception, because in the end, a surgeon is not judged by other surgeons or by how Hollywood would judge that surgeon. A surgeon is judged by how many people he or she did not kill, right? So that's very different. So that's the idea of the who is the judge. And in the end, I tell people, who judges the expert? It's not another expert in the end. Who judges the other expert? Who do you think? Sorry? Time, or a substitute for time, a lady called Lindy. Now, Lindy is what I start describing as a survival of things, okay, what survives, tends to have some pattern. Things that have been surviving for 20 years survive 20 more years. Non-perishable items, I'm not talking about individuals. Technologies that have been around for 1,000 years, 1,000 more years. Okay, this chair, Pharaonic Egypt, you know, 3,251 years and three quarters maybe. Okay, that was a throne before. The Romans didn't like you to sit on chairs, that was a throne, right? So technology and of course technologies can be destroyed by other technologies, like the computer, the desktop destroyed by the laptop, destroyed by the iPad and some of the tablets. And the tablet effectively is, you know, used to have tablets 6,000 years ago. So anyway, so then Lindy, so time should judge. For Lindy to work, you must have contact with reality, a filter of reality working on it. So by now, you pretty much have an idea of how to frame things related to bureaucrats versus doers. And you realize pretty much that bureaucrats are all gonna fall in a category of looking the part, giving complicated stuff, because there is no Lindy that works on it. There's no contact with reality. There's no nothing. So let me wrap up this first part by explaining the following. Let's go back to Darwinian evolution. How do restaurants improve in New York? Because a chef learns? No. How do they improve? Via bankruptcy, okay? You want people to be subjected to failure, and better fail early than late, because systems in biology don't learn via textbooks or brains. How do they learn? At the cellular level, via selection. So you need to have a lot of small variations and a lot of things going for systems to learn, for systems to improve, okay? So the restaurants will never learn because the government puts chefs through a course to make them better. No, it learned via death. I mean, not death of a restaurant, not the chef, although sometimes, in some cases, it may be a recommended solution, all right? But I mean, I've had awful food before. Okay, so let's move to something that has attracted a lot of attention in Brazil, and particularly before here, and continue this idea of skin in the game, linked to the continuation of something in Antifragile, which is scaling, okay? This is an elephant next to a mouse. What's the main difference between them? Sorry? Size. Now, is it qualitative or quantitative? Sorry? Quantitative? No, it's mostly qualitative. Hugely qualitative, even more. For the following reason. How many elephants do we have still around? They can't, if the population-wise, they can't fill a small town in Brazil. How many rats do we have? We have more rats in New York City than humans, so like 8.7 million rats or something. We don't even know because they're good at hiding, right? So please don't do the experiment yourself, or if you do it, don't tell anyone. But if you throw a rat out the window, it would laugh at you. If an elephant falls from here, what happens? It's gone. It breaks a leg, it's gone. So the difference is qualitative because as you grow in size, you have this, a lot of things change with the size. You become vastly more fragile. Elephants also have one advantage. They live longer, but they're the first to go extinct. The mammoth, I know there were mammoths when they had the pyramids in Egypt, when they had already built the Great Pyramid, the Cheops Pyramid. They had mammoths. So the next animal to go extinct is not going to be the rat, it's the elephant. Large animals. Same thing with corporations. Corporation, if you want a corporation to commit suicide, reach a level when you can enter the S&P 500. Expected duration in the S&P 500 today, 11 years. What was it in the 80s? I went to business school, I'm very, very old. 60 it was, okay? So the more complex the environment, the more fragility, the less cooperation. Let's now move into political systems with something drastic. You will, and okay, you guys stop reading, so I'll go back to the elephant, all right? So the thing is, whenever you say, I am Republican, Marxist, this, that, libertarian, libertarian, whatever you want, you have to attach a scale to it. You have to say, I'm libertarian at the mouse level, but a Republican at the elephant level. You see the point? Let's think about it. It's perfectly, I am Marxist with my family. Marxist, share everything, you know, and okay. I'm a little less Marxist with my extended family, more like a socialist maybe. And then as you go up, okay, I'm libertarian at the federal level, okay? So the scale matters. So you cannot talk politics without scale. That's volume 6 of the Inserto, which may be only 30 pages on scale. Because if you start thinking about it, these terms, liberty, all right, or two things, has to have a scale attached to it, okay? So you're not free within the sound of this, but I want to be free with respect to that. And also you should do the fractal order, that the relationship between the symmetry between individuals should be replicated with the same symmetry between towns. You don't mess with me, I don't mess with you. You treat others like you'd like, you don't treat them like you don't want to be treated, and goes all the way up to states. Now, this is sentence has been from skin in the game has been spreading like wildfire. A person saying one can be libertarian at a federal level, Republican at a state level, Democrat at a country level, socialist within a commune, and communist at a family level. Okay? And I don't know if you can be even worse with your dog or whatever, something like that. So you decide. So the whole idea of scaling destroys a lot of things. You cannot say Singapore is successful, therefore let's replicate it. 200 million people versus 6 million. It doesn't work. Okay? You cannot say that Canada had a great health plan, let's apply it to the United States. It doesn't work. 300 million versus 30, it doesn't work. It doesn't scale. And a lot of things, the city-state model has been historically the most successful one. Because city-states, as an entity, have the right scale. Not too small, not too big. Then when we look at the success of Germany, people don't understand Germany. Germany is not a country. Germany is a real federation. Okay? The success of Germany comes from the fact that when you are decentralized, you effectively have a lot of small states. Corporations cannot be very large. You see? And the other virtue of centralization is skin in the game. Let's think about it. Let's take the most decentralized country on this planet ever, which is also the most successful one, and also the one with the most boring people, but don't tell them. Which country is it? Switzerland, all right? Very, very boring people, but look at the political system. Very decentralized, and look what it did. They have great skiing, all right? Because they have great snow because of decentralization. Anyway. Maybe there's a connection, but there's high statistical correction. Anyway. So, in Switzerland, the mayor who makes the decision, lives in a community. Let's think about it. Someone in Brasilia or in Washington is judged by a spreadsheet. So if you make a mistake, okay, it's a number. But if you make a mistake in Switzerland, guess what? You go to a cafe on Sunday to read the matin, whatever, and to drink your coffee, you got people coming by to insult you, all right? So you have an emotional skin in the game, you feel shame. Shame is a great regulator. So decentralization had that effect that decisions are never separated from their consequences. You see? Whereas what we have here in this environment is decisions separated from their consequences, okay, as you go higher. And this is quite central. People don't get it. That kept writing in Anti-Fragile how the most obvious country to emulate is Switzerland because nobody knows who the president is. And they can name probably every president on the planet, but not theirs because they don't know who it is. Because the real president is the mayor. And another person reported that effectively it works well because there is a scale transformation, what we call scale transformation, people hating one another because every commune hates another commune in Switzerland. I don't know if you know that. Okay? Aggregates to something very healthy at the total level. So nothing comes from the top except things that can only be done from the top, like wars or defense or the train system. For some weird reason, they really think the train system should come from a central state and nothing else. Okay, so the bulk of your taxes go to the community. So you see your taxes. I'm willing to pay more taxes if I see it tomorrow morning, you know, in a cleaner pavement. Okay, so. But also the effect it had on Germany is that the French wanted to punish the Germans. And the French had that notion, there was this whole belief that actually messed up a lot of countries, mostly in Latin America, that central state was a good thing. So the French still had that belief when Germany fell in 1945, and they said, okay, we're going to make it a federation to punish them so they don't invade us again, because, you know, Bismarck unified, invade, Hitler invades. So they said, and effectively what they did, they gave a huge gift to Germany, particularly that the absence of a central state means no company is going to be very large. Because there's a dynamics that you observe between size of corporations. Even Switzerland has a few exceptions, but usually when you have a central state, companies tend to cluster, okay, and being very large, and they leech on the state, and it becomes the same employees going back and forth, stuff like that, okay? You don't have that in such an environment. So that's one link between decentralization and the other thing. Now I need to wrap up. Someone stole from me 15 minutes, but I have to wrap up. Either it's a hint, it will start 45 minutes, but, you know, the possession is 9/10 of the law, as you know. And so let me finish and wrap up about what I said. I tried to explain here the virtues of a lot of the ideas that you guys have, but seen from a different prism. Okay, contact with reality, not be judged by peers, having skin in the game as an engine for stability and risk-taking, and valuing those who take risks versus those who don't take risks. Incidentally, I was telling you that Bush the father was a prisoner of war, but I don't know if you've heard this guy, what's his name, the fellow who was head of the CIA, and he was a big military person. Everybody respected him. The guy had never seen a battle. What was the name? They called him genius up till he was caught because he had a mistress and he was doing something funny. He was a CIA male. I forgot his name. Had never seen a battle. So how can you have peace if those who decide on war are never affected by war? They're never killed by war. You cannot have peace under these conditions. They sit in an air conditioning office. They promote war, like Thomas Friedman, who writes for the New York Times. You know, I name names. So he wanted the Iraq War. The Iraq War killed all these people. Did it kill him? No. His same office in Washington, you know, and he takes he has his commute. He drives, you know, 10 minutes to work, air-conditioned car, air-conditioned office, very good. And then tens of thousands of people lost their lives. And we lost $7 trillion, maybe, because of these wars. So this is the problem of separating people from consequences of their actions. And decentralization does some of that. One more thing I wanted to mention about politics is that it's always harder than you think. And something about metastatic bureaucracies and how systems like to sustain themselves, parasitic systems. One British minister called me up after reading, I won't name him, but he called me up after reading Skin in the Game. And he called me, he said, listen, you're wrong on something. I said, what? He said, you think that all these problems come from ministers. He said, we have absolutely no control of our ministries. People have been there 30 years. They exert passive resistance. They anonymize their decisions. And people who run Western democracies, even when you think that it's a ministry, at the head of someone that came with a government that was elected in some form or another, even then you think that they would have control. They don't have the time. So the only way we can solve that problem is by reducing these ministries, transferring them, spreading them out, never have a center, because you cannot, even when you elect new people, I mean, Donald Trump had no control of Washington. That proved it was the FBI. So you cannot, people on the inside, employees, will always run the show. And the corporations that hire these employees, even more. I don't know if you guys know, but Monsanto was writing the documents of the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Why? Because the employees of the EPA, their dream is one day to go work for three times their salary for Monsanto. So you're going to be nice to Monsanto because you're underpaid in their mind. I'm sure they're overpaid, but you think they're underpaid because they can get a job with, same thing with Boeing. Boeing controls the FAA. Okay, same thing, same story. Okay, so you end up having that cozy relationship between industry and these people, and you're head of the agency, you know, appointed by Trump or the next president or anyone else, you have no control. So the solution has to be structural, not, the solution cannot be, you know, done by, via politics without something, some deep surgery. You can't just put, change the faces and think you're going to solve the problem. Now, I'm very honored to be in Brazil for many reasons. I have three cousins here that I know of in this room, okay? And there was a lot of immigration from Lebanon coming to Brazil. And in 1910, 20, 30, Brazil took us, or I mean, I wasn't born, but they took us because we needed somewhere to go in the Ottoman Empire when there were persecutions and a very tough economic environment. So they came to Brazil. They didn't pick, the bulk of them came to Brazil and Argentina. They did not pick the United States. Why? Because they thought the money was here. The country of the future was this country. Argentina and Brazil were, in their minds, the countries of the future. Now, what happened? Nothing happened. Good people tried to do good things. The problem is, you don't need good people. And the last thing sometimes is for good people to do good things. What you need is, I'd rather have not good people, but a good system. So basically, it was self-harm by governmental, you know, government trying to do what they think they can do, when in fact, you just want them to take a vacation. So thank you very much. I'm extremely honored to be here. Thank you for inviting me.